Alright, so I need some feedback. Last class, there was more detail than we could go through than we had time. And so whenever there's too much detail and too much information in class, it's pretty easy to get overwhelmed, and it's pretty easy just to have your head spin just because there's so much going on. And Revelation has a lot of detail. It's important that we get that detail, because if we don't understand what the book is saying, then we can't make any application. Or whatever application we make will be based on a faulty foundation. So it's really important that we understand what's being said before we can actually make the application. So the feedback is this. The feedback I need is this. So at our current pace, I can either A, keep up kind of what we're doing and keep our heads spinning for the next few classes, and we're going to rush through more detail than we have time. Or we can do something a little bit different. I need like a class or two or maybe three tops to beyond what we have time allotted. So what we can do is either A, kind of keep doing what we're doing, or B, after this class is over, meet outside of services one, two, or three times at my house or here at the building, and we can finish this right. So, need a show of hands. Which pace would you like? Would you like for A, for us to keep going at the pace we're going, where we're just cramming and flying through the detail? If so, raise your hand. All right, so we won't do that. Now, let me get a show of hands for interest. If we were to have additional classes, either at our house or at the building, in some way after this class was over, how many of you would be interested in attending that? Okay, that's good. So that's what we'll do. So that's great. That'll give us a little bit of room to breathe. All right. So we'll slow down a little bit, but we're not going to do this excessively. We want to make sure that we continue kind of a reasonable pace. Now, that being said, I want to go back and look at a little bit of the detail that we talked about last time. I don't want to spend too much time here, but I think this is something I could have been a little bit more clear on, and I want to make sure that we understand this. So as we talk about the beast that was and is not, and then it's back from the abyss, and it's going to be again. There are two possibilities, and I think there's good merit for both of these, and I can't pick out myself which one it is. So one is that the empire, Roman Empire itself, was on the brink of disaster through the incompetence and immorality of its emperors, and then it comes back. So we have the beast being the Roman Empire, almost being destroyed and kind of coming back from the brink of destruction. The other idea is that, and this is supported by the idea that we've already seen the beast as a composite beast, made up of pieces of the empires that have gone before it. It could be that the beast represents all of these empires. So in a sense, you have a succession of empires. The idea that we have a force that is anti-God, opposed to God, possibly even viciously persecuting its saints, and then it's destroyed. It goes away. But then the next empire ends up eventually doing the exact same thing. It goes away, and then it comes back. So we have the succession of empires that they are, and then they're not, and then they're back. And so you have this thing that's just kind of repeating in the different empires. And the idea would be is, why is this happening? It's because there's a force behind this beast that keeps coming back and keeps coming back. And he persists. The devil is consistent and persistent in all of these governments that are opposed to God. And so he continues, and he is the source of this. So idea is either the beast is the empire, or we have a succession, a repeating occurrence of these beasts over and over again. And they're exemplified or typified by a single beast because there is a single source that's behind them. All right, so those two ideas, those make sense. All right. By the way, you never ask people if that makes sense because they always say yes. So, but anyway, does that make sense? So, now, we talked about that last time. I want to revisit the heads real quick, maybe with a little bit more clarity. First of all, it's interesting that Rome was literally built on top of seven hills. Not seven mountains, but actually seven hills. And if you look at a map of Rome today, you can see that. So, but we're talking about a book of symbols. So that may have been a clue, but ultimately this is something that we need to interpret symbolically to be consistent with verse 1 of chapter 1 and how else we've been dealing with the book. So a couple of details on one approach. Maybe these represent emperors, like specific emperors that existed. The problem with this is depending on where you count, you come up with different interpretations. I forget the exact number, but there was probably like 40 or 50 different total emperors of Rome. All right, so you have a really hard time matching that to 7 or 8. So if you begin with Augustus, this is one of the more popular ones. Then the fifth one is Nero. So he would be kind of like the last of the ones that had passed. The sixth would be Vespasian, and then his son Titus. And then the eighth one would be Domitian. All right, so it kind of fits well with the idea of the ones that were and are not, and the one that's coming, Domitian is coming. The problem is, if you take that, it dates the book in the middle of Vespasian's rule. And that's not the early date or the late date. So this is something that doesn't fit the dating of either highly contended possibility for dating the book. So it kind of falls apart there. All right. And then not to mention, we got the problem that there was a lot more emperors that came after Domitian, and Diocletian was one of the later ones, and he was arguably even like the worst persecutor of all the emperors. So it kind of doesn't fit well with that. One idea we talked about last time, maybe this represents all the different provinces and kingdoms that comprise the Roman Empire, but the problem is this doesn't explain how it was and is not. Otherwise, it would fit pretty well. So one of the other ideas is that either literally or maybe symbolically, again, back to the idea that we're talking about a succession of empires, one rising and one falling. So maybe these heads represent the actual individual empires that make up this composite beast, how they come into existence or not. So literally, you could have like ancient Babylon, and then Assyria, and then Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. But I think it's probably better to understand this symbolically. And so Rome would be the one that now is. We would have one in the future. That might be the last empire to face Christianity at the very end. But there's problems with this idea. The problem is there's going to be a lot of empires between Rome and this last one. So how do we account for those in this numbering? Symbolically or figuratively. It just doesn't line up very well. And the other thing is we're going to see in another chapter that this beast is cast into the lake that burns with fire. And we don't see him anymore. And so how do we account for this representing the beasts that are going to be coming through the oncoming years as other nations rise and oppose God and oppose his people? So I think these are some of the better guesses. There's problems with some of these. Maybe with more time and study, we can figure out and reconcile some of these things. Now, do these possibilities make sense? Anybody have a favorite that stands out one over the other? Any other comments to add? All right. So we can keep chewing on this. And then the horns, we talked about this briefly. These would be 10 kings. This is consistent with what we saw in Daniel 7. The idea is that the horn, and then Brother Duggan talked about this last night. The horn is the most powerful part of the beast. It's kind of what's leading the charge. So we have kings that are leading the charge here. And so as opposed to being the emperors, these are most likely petty kings or provincial rulers. And the reason that that's thought is because of the description here. They're hoping to have some authority. They're looking for some authority. So this wouldn't be the emperors. They have that authority. All right, so these are people who just want to be a part. They want to share in the authority and the power of Rome. So this would be people like Herod, Pilate, and people like that who are provincial rulers who are hoping to share in this in some way. So they do have some power. It's increased, but only for a little while. But these are going to be the things that are actually leading the local charge, if you will, against the saints, persecuting God's people. And then here we have the powerful verse. They're going to make this war with the Lamb, but the Lamb's going to overcome them because he is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. And those who are with them are called, chosen, and faithful. So that's a very powerful verse for us to think about as well. If we've answered the call, if we've shown ourselves as being chosen, are we remaining faithful? Are we staying faithful in the face of this kind of persecution and this kind of force and influence and temptation to compromise? All right, that kind of catches us up with last time. Any other questions or comments or thoughts on any of this? All right. So let's wrap up a few things real quick and then move into chapter 18. So what's the significance of the waters where the harlot sits? I think we may have answered this last time, but I forgot. All right, so we have lots of different people. So the angel tells us specifically these are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. I think this becomes an important clue to understanding the waters and the sea as we've seen throughout the book of Revelation. Now, I think this is interesting because it goes really well back in Daniel 2. Remember the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had? He saw the feet and the legs were iron, and down at the feet they were mixed with clay. And the point was, is the iron and the clay wouldn't mix. They would just stay as like the individual little pieces. And this is the situation we see in Rome. This started in Greece, but it's certainly true in Rome. They've conquered all these people, but they've not been able to amalgamate them into a single cohesive empire. They still end up being individual little pieces of ethnicities and languages and nations. And so they kind of got them working together, but they're never, ever able to really unite them. And so this will continue to be a problem for Rome and ultimately contribute to its downfall. All right. Couple other ideas as we think about the other possible ways of interpreting this. If we take the preterist position and say, well, this is Jerusalem. Well, did Jerusalem reign over many different peoples, nations, languages? No, that doesn't fit a description of Jerusalem in any kind of way. And then the other common view is that this represents Rome in some way, that here we have in this harlot, this is the corrupted church. This is the papal Rome. But that would apply to something that's, you know, 1,000+ years away from these people. And we're told in verse 1 of the book, these are things which must shortly take place. All right, so that's an interpretation that fails to be consistent with the context. All right, any thoughts or questions on this so far? All right, so one more. I think this is a good lesson, and then we'll leave this chapter. So what surprising, even ironic attitude do the horns manifest toward the harlot? They hate her. Here we have this beast, the horns of the beast, and this woman who sits on them. She's supported by this. And they're all kind of together, but yet the horns hate her. And then what do they end up as a consequence doing to her? They destroy her. So what we're told is they hate her, they make her desolate and naked, eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. All right, now why is this happening? Because God's put it into their hearts to fulfill his purpose. He's using these nations, these individual puppet kings and all these different things that comprise the empire for a time. And then what is the lesson? What does this tell us about the weakness, the inherent weakness in the dragon's army? And wicked people in general. They're selfish. And what happens when you try to band together a bunch of selfish people under a common goal? No, it doesn't. Eventually, it falls apart. So you may have heard the expression, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. All right. So you can take people who have very different, even competing goals. But if they share a single goal, as long as that goal exists, they can work together. But once that goal is realized or given enough time, they're going to turn on each other. And so we have a similar thing that's happening here in this beast. It can't ever really succeed. It's going to ultimately always destroy itself because of the nature of the people that make it up. So this is a fundamental weakness that cannot be overcome in the dragon's army because this is the way the dragon is. This is who he is, and it extends from his philosophy and the way that he works. All right, so we have this spirit of ill will and treachery. So ultimately, these influences are going to sabotage the empire, and they're going to work together for as long as it suits them. But eventually, they're going to turn on each other. And this idea is, as we've seen in previous texts, in Ezekiel 16, we also see this idea of the people turning on and destroying the city, one of the cities we've talked about. Now, one of the things that I want to bring up is this is a common reoccurring theme, this spirit, if you will, throughout the Bible. One of my favorite stories is in Judges 9 with the king Abimelech. He goes and he reaches out to the men of Shechem, and they commit treachery. And then it says in verse 1 of chapter 9 that God, maybe it's verse 24, God puts it into their heart and sends this spirit of ill will and treachery. They turn on each other and they end up tearing each other apart. And this is something that we see that God uses over and over again in manipulating people, using them for a time, taking them to his advantage to mete out his punishment and judgment. Edom, Moab, and Ammon, they turn on each other and attack against Jehoshaphat, 2 Chronicles 20. Midianites turn on each other in Judges 7 against Gideon. And then the Philistines turn on each other in 1 Samuel 14:20 as they're fighting Saul. So reoccurring things, fundamental nature, to evil people. And that's part of the reason why it doesn't bother me when we have to deal with people, maybe even the church or elsewhere, that are wicked. That at the end of the day, they're selfish people. I know, just given a matter of time, they're going to self-destruct. They're going to tear each other apart. So they may succeed for a little while, but ultimately God will win, and the result of people's wickedness will come back upon them because of the path they've chosen. All right, any questions or thoughts about any of this? All right, so there is a message of comfort in this, recognizing this. Now, we've talked about this all along the way, so I won't delay this. Who or what does the beast represent, and who or what does the harlot represent? So he tells us that the woman is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Again, this would eliminate Jerusalem as a possible application. The only thing that this makes sense for is Rome. So just looking at a few common points, notice the scarlet beast is the same as the sea beast of 13:1, same description of Daniel chapter 7. He's waging the same war as the fourth beast of Daniel 7, the same war as the fourth kingdom of Daniel 2. Why do we look at that? If you go back to Daniel, it makes it very clear. The first three kingdoms of Daniel 2 and chapter 7 are named out for us in that book. Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. What was the kingdom that came after these three kingdoms? Rome. And this is the kingdom that was the fourth empire by history. And then we also know that the church was established during the Roman Empire, which persecuted the church. So there is no doubt that the Scarlet Beast is the Roman Empire. It's the only thing that fits the facts of the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation. Now, looking at the harlot, notice she rules and influences many nations, ethnicities. She rules over all the kings. She entices others to fight God and kill his saints. She's wealthy, seductive, alluring, and immoral. She's symbolized by the ancient Babylonian capital, and she's described as the mother of harlots and abominations. Her wealth and immoral influence is supported and spread by the empire's conquest. So these are two entities that are closely tied together. So the empire is furthering her attitude, her demeanor, her influence. So based on that, and the fact that she's ultimately hated and sabotaged by her constituents, I don't think there's any doubt that this can be the capital city of Rome. This is the Roman city itself. So this is the thing that rides on the empire, that's supported by it, and has this ungodly influence on the entire world. So through her emperors and through all of her people, we see this. All right, any questions about this? Any comments or anything? All right. So I won't spend time here. I'll leave this for you to look at later. Notice the main point is the beast and the harlot are basically doing the same thing. Again, these two entities are very closely tied together. So there's no way this can be Jerusalem or any other city. These two things are tied too closely together to be separated in any kind of way. And this relationship doesn't fit any other city or any other empire from a different empire. All right, so now let's get into chapter 18. So what we've seen so far up to this point is this great harlot, this great city of Rome. We've seen the justification for her fall, all right? And we've seen the fact that she is going to fall. Now what we're going to do is we're going to look at reaction, all right? We're going to see what happens as a consequence of this. All right, so we talked about this quite a bit last time. I don't want to spend too much time on this. It's very profitable to go back and look at the Old Testament prophecies and see how the description of the capital cities of the empires of that day corresponds so well to their destruction a destruction in time of those empires. And that helps us to understand what's going to happen to Rome. Helps us to see the immorality. This is something that, again, has existed in many empires from this. So one of the things I want to look at in this chapter is just briefly seeing, revisiting some of these passages to notice this common attitude in the destruction that actually is a consequence of this. So that is completely out of place. I grabbed the wrong slide and moved it. All right, we'll dance around this. All right, so let's look at the first three verses. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice. So all of this gives emphasis to the importance of what he's saying. Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Now, this is a saying that we've seen before. All right, we have the exact same thing summarized in chapter 14, verse 8, that Babylon is fallen. So what is the difference between these two? We saw it in chapter 14, and now we see it in chapter 18. What is different about the context of these two passages?
Seems like this one's talking about the moral destruction of it, that's fallen completely morally.
Okay. So there is definitely elaboration on the moral, the justification for why this is happening and how wicked this harlot is. So previously in chapter 14, we just have her touched upon, just briefly mentioned without elaboration. We're getting a lot more detail in these two chapters. Anything else?
Where is it in 14?
14, verse 8.
Oh, thanks. Mm-hmm.
What is the difference in the timeline at this point? Where were we in chapter 14 in the timeline of Revelation? Right. So right before the actual destruction happens and everything's being torn apart. So they're both written in the past tense. Remember we talked about in 14:8, this is the prophetic past. So this is a tense that we often find in the prophets where God speaks with, and the point is to indicate great certainty. He talks about future events, things that have not yet happened, as if they have happened. All right? So this is something we see in Romans 4:17 where Paul there makes a point about this. So in chapter 14, he's looking forward to an event that hasn't happened. And to make it very certain and to emphasize the fact that it's going to happen, he speaks about it in the past tense. When we get to chapter 18, the event has passed. All right? So he's looking back on this. It truly has passed. The thing that makes it complicated is he's foretelling this point in time that has not yet occurred. But in the context of what he's talking about, Babylon has fallen. Rome has been destroyed, and they're looking back on it. And so this is the indication in this text, beyond any doubt, what are we talking about? Babylon, Rome has fallen. Now we're going to look at the reaction of that. So chapter 14, both of them are in past tense. 14's looking forward and using the past tense for certainty. Chapter 18 is looking back, it's reflecting, it's creating reaction or describing the reaction. However, all of these events are looking forward to the future. But in the timeline of Revelation, they're in two different points. Make sense? Okay. All right. So the other thing is Morgan said, we've got more detail about the kings actually committing fornication and then also the merchants who are introduced here. Taking advantage of this situation. All right, very quickly, this cage for every unclean and hated bird, the idea this is a dwelling place of demons. This is used in Isaiah 34, at least the idea of all these different animals living here. And the idea is here's a place that used to have princes and nobles and all these things, having these meetings and working through things, and now we have pelicans and ostriches and wild beasts of the wilderness, and they're conducting the meetings. They're having these things talking back and forth to each other. And so the place is desolate. It's been brought to ruin. And so this is a figure that's emphasizing that. Somebody else suggested that that the old buildings that would stay around, the old monuments like the Colosseum and all these things that are empty and broken down, would kind of be a haunting place. And so the idea of the demons being there would be the buildings and the things that produce this kind of eerie, haunting environment. All right. So we have this warning that's interjected. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of their wrath, of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. The merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, so something just kind of interrupts this angel here, this other voice. Come out of her, my people. So this is going to be either Jesus or God the Father that's speaking, because he's calling them my people. Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. All right, so the idea is that her sins are just piling up, piling up, piling up, piling up, and finally they get to a tipping point. So this is an illustration of the end of patience. All right, it's not like God has forgotten, and now all of a sudden he remembers all the bad things that Rome has done. What has happened is those events transpire, and he's patient, 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 and there comes a point in time where he thinks about it again, looks at it again with the mind to bring judgment. And so now it's an accommodative term that shows God beginning to act in memory of the things that have happened up to this point. Now, so we have this end of patience, but we have this warning to come out of her. All right, so how is this similar to other texts that we've seen, maybe in this book or other books? Where else is this theme emphasized? To come out of her and avoid partaking in her sins and her destruction.
Remind me of the verse, be in the world but not of the world. That's not exactly coming out of something. That's just not participating.
But that's a part of it, right? I mean, a piece of this is definitely spiritual, and that's probably the fundamental application, is that these people were not to take of the same spirit and be spiritually the same people as these. Because if they did, they would share in the destruction. Maybe physically, but certainly spiritually, they would end up in the same place, no doubt. All right. So, remember, the nations and the kings and the merchants, they've already been seduced and compromised, and they've partaken of her sins, and they're doomed with her. Now, given that fact, and what we've talked about before, about her having this great and powerful influence, it's very natural for Jesus to interject this warning at this point, not to be overcome with her allure and with her influence, and not to compromise and sin like all these other people. Otherwise, they'll partake in this. So, I think this is probably one of the most pointed warnings here, but in chapter 2, 14, and then verses 20 through 22, we read about some of the seven churches were those who had already eaten the meat sacrificed to idols and committed fornication with Jezebel. And then in chapter 12, 11, and verse 17, and then chapter 14, 7 through 12, we have the idea that people need to maintain their purity and that they need to overcome. So this is something we've seen before, but it's most pointed here. All right. So this is a verse, this thought is something that we see in other passages. In Zechariah 2, verses 6 through 10, God tells his people to flee from the land of the north. Right? The north would be Babylon compared to Israel. And he says, up Zion, escape you who dwell with the daughter of Babylon. All right? So there he's very explicit. And then he says, I will shake my hand against them, and they shall become spoil for their servants. And then he tells them to sing and rejoice, for behold, I am coming and will dwell in your midst. So we have several different messages that we find in this Old Testament prophecy that apply well and fit well and are repeated here in Revelation. First of all, get out of there. Escape. Don't have any part of this. Part of the reason is judgment and damnation is coming on these people. So escape that. Get out of that. Don't be a part of that. Don't suffer with that. And then also this message of hope that we've seen throughout the book of Revelation, that God, Jesus, is going to reign in the kingdoms of men, and that the saints are going to reign with them, that he's going to turn the kingdom over to the saints, and that he's going to dwell with them. So we have this same idea even here in Zechariah chapter 2 that's being repeated. All right, so I think fundamentally the primary application is to not compromise. Separate yourself spiritually. 2 Peter 2 about being sojourners and pilgrims. We need to consider ourselves as such and make sure that we don't partake in these things. All right, now I'm going to go back and hit these slides that I missed before that were out of order. All right. So, another good passage is 2 Corinthians 6. Remember what Paul said to the Corinthians, you're restricted by your own affections. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what fellowship, what communion, what accord, what part, what agreement does the people of God have with the wicked people? So again, what's the instruction? Come out from among them and be separate. Do not touch any unclean thing. So the emphasis on this passage, and I think also in Revelation as well, is the spiritual. Come out from among them. Don't be part of them. This doesn't represent necessarily physical leaving, but it represents spiritual, not being joined with them, cleansing ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit. And again, what's the idea? What's the reward, the promise? That God will dwell with us, that He will have a relationship with us. So same point to come out of this doomed city. So separating themselves spiritually, but I think also, I don't think it's the primary point, but it could also be the point, the physical as well. This is not an uncommon idea. Remember what Jesus told the Jews in Matthew 24. He told them to look for the signs for when Rome would come and conquer to Jerusalem. He told them specifically what to look for so they wouldn't get caught in the destruction of Jerusalem. And Josephus tells us that there was no Christians that were destroyed in the destruction of Jerusalem. They all found the signs and they managed to escape. A sad example of this, in my estimation, is in Jeremiah 39, up into chapter 40. After Jerusalem is destroyed, one of Nebuchadnezzar's agents, Nebuzaradan, who's kind of the captain who's actually leading the destruction of Jerusalem, he comes and he finds Jeremiah, calls him out by name, and he says, I was given instruction concerning you, and you were specifically allowed to go wherever you wanted. You can come back with us, and I'll take care of you, or you can go and you can stay with Gedaliah. Jeremiah delays. He doesn't answer right away, and as a consequence, Nebuzaradan says, look, maybe you should just go stay with Gedaliah, but if you want to come with us, that's fine too. So he gives him one more chance, and then Nebuzaradan leaves. So Jeremiah misses his opportunity, if you will, to flee and go and be in Babylon, to be part of the remnant that was spared, and to be with people like Daniel, who, in my estimation, probably was the one responsible for Nebuzaradan's very specific instructions. Jeremiah missed that opportunity. As a consequence, he was carried off by the unfaithful against his will to Egypt. And he was ultimately, he died there with all of the godless of the people that survived in Jerusalem. He had a window of opportunity after God's judgment physically came on Jerusalem where he could have avoided even more, and he missed it. So Matthew 7:6 talks about not casting your pearls before swine, lest they turn and they rend you underfoot. It's important to understand that God brings judgment both spiritually but physically in our time. And to recognize, He almost always provides a window where we have the opportunity to preach and to teach and rebuke and warn. But before the final judgment falls, we can escape. If we're watching, if we're paying attention, we have a window. Don't miss the window. Make sure you are paying attention and make sure you don't suffer with those who are going to fall because of their complete stubbornness and their wickedness. So a very important lesson, I think, to pull out of this as well. Not a spiritual lesson just to save yourself physically some suffering and some difficulty. All right. Any questions or thoughts about this? All right. So now let me catch back up with where we were. All right, now let's talk about the double. Render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works. In the cup which she has mixed, mix double for her. In the measure that she glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen and am no widow and will not see sorrow. So does this mean that God says, well, you've done this, so that was really bad, so I'm going to make you pay double? Is he making the punishment exceed the crime?
The more the punishment that they've been putting on the Christians, it's very physical and it's only earthly and it's temporary. But the punishment and justice that they're going to get is going to be eternal.
So there's a couple different possibilities. One is the idea that this is a physical punishment that they're going to literally suffer in this life, but then spiritually they're going to suffer as well, in eternity in hell. So that is a possibility. Another possibility is, and this one's a little bit more of a stretch, like figuratively, but I think it may get a little bit closer to the meaning. The idea is that if you think about a set of scales, we have a set of evil on the other side. This persecution, this torment, this sin, what is it going to take to balance the scales? You need something equal. You need basically a doubling, if you will. There's twice as much as there was before. So everything that she did is going to happen back to her. It's going to repeat. Something's going to happen to her of equal measure. So overall, we have a doubling of the original trouble, of the torment and the sorrow that she created. And notice that I think the text is part of the reason why I lean more confidently or certainly in this, is that the text says that it was in the same measure. Okay, whatever she gave is coming right back to her, not anymore. Okay, so that makes it clear that however we define this, we've got to understand this was equal to what she did, not actually a true doubling of what happened. So I think that helps us establish that. All right, any other comments or thoughts on this? All right. One thing I did want to pull from Isaiah 47 that we talked about last time, this I think is staggering and it fits well with the comments that you see actually Rome saying of herself. She says, this is ancient Babylon. She's the lady of kingdoms. I'll be a lady forever. So she didn't take the warnings to heart. She's given to pleasure. She considers herself to dwell securely. And she says in her heart, all right, you guys from Bible drill, notice this very specific language, I am. And there is no one else beside me. What is she saying?
She's God.
She's God. All right. She says, this punishment will not come upon me. He says, it'll come in a moment because of the multitude of your sorceries, the great abundance of your enchantments. You have trusted in your wickedness. You have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge have warped you. You have said in your heart, and again, repeating what has already been said for emphasis, I am, and there is no one else beside me. All right. Tyre, we talked about this the other night. She said the same thing. Her heart is lifted up. I am a god. I sit in the seat of gods. He says, you are a man and not a god. And he talks about her splendor being defiled. And then he has this very powerful and ironic thing. So the person who comes to kill you, will you tell him that you're a god and not a man? You're going to be a man in his hands because he's going to kill you. And so we have a very powerful condemnation on Tyre and a great irony of her arrogance. And we see the exact same thing in Rome. What does she say? I sit as a queen, and I am no widow, and I will not see sorrow. Oh, yes, she will. All right, thank you guys. Y'all did very good. We'll pick up with there next time, and we'll just keep trucking. Thanks for your comments and your preparation and participation.